Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Throughout history, why have women's contributions to the world gone largely uncredited, been erased entirely, or otherwise diminished in importance? A new book explores that question while giving hundreds of unsung women their due. Women like Mary Sherman Morgan, who invented rocket fuel that launched the first satellite into orbit, but was denied an obituary in the Los Angeles Times. And she's just one of many women featured in the new book, Uncredited: Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. Author Allison Tyra joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Allison.
Thanks so much.
So I have to say that the title of your book really reeled me in. I was curious to read about the there's 600 stories and thousands of women that you wrote about, that you chronicled. And to me, some of them I've heard of, yes, but many of them I have not heard of. And I guess that's the point, right?
Yeah, and actually, a lot of people might be surprised to know that, like, Marie Curie is in there. And why is the most famous woman scientist, like the only woman scientist that a lot of Westerners can name, why would she be in this book? Because she almost didn't win the Nobel. They didn't want to give it to her. They were only going to credit her husband, Pierre, and basically treat her like his assistant, which is a recurring theme in the book. And one of the other prominent male scientists of the time heard about this. He goes to Pierre, tells him what's going to happen. Pierre and a third prominent male scientist go to the Nobel committee and basically fight for her, right? So if these three prominent men had not gone and pushed for her to be recognized, we wouldn't know who Marie Curie is, most likely.
You are also the creator and editor of Infinite Women. That's an online biographical database with more than 6,000 entries and growing. And you also host an accompanying weekly podcast. So did that work give you a jump start for this idea of writing a book?
So the database is actually where I got all of my research from. Was while I was working on that, I kept seeing the same stories over and over again. And what makes Infinite Women unique, as far as I know, is that I don't specify a type of woman, right? So most databases are geographical or by field or a particular trait, like Black women or queer women. Infinite Women is all the femme/female identifying folks that I can find throughout history, and to a lesser extent today. It's mostly historical. But just to give you an idea, like, that's how broad a range of people I'm looking at, right? Basically, unless you're a cis dude.
I got it.
Yeah. And so when you keep seeing the same patterns over and over and over again, despite time, despite location, despite field, you start making notes, at least if you're me. And then when you have like 600 notes, you write a book.
Right. Okay. And then you, in your book, there's 600 stories, but thousands of women are represented because some of those stories represent more than one woman. Do I have that right?
Yes. So, for example, you might have a smaller group like the ENIAC programmers who made the first computer work, right? They were basically given a machine and said, make it work. But that was several women. Or, you know, on a broader scale, I talk about the steamboat ladies. So these are women who earned degrees at Oxford and Cambridge, but Oxford and Cambridge wouldn't actually give them their degrees because they were women. But at the time, those two universities had reciprocity with Trinity College in Dublin. So the president at Trinity basically said, why don't we just give them the degrees that they earned, and sort of like put that offer out. And 720 women hopped on the steamboat to Dublin and were like, here's my transcript. And Trinity was like, cool, here's a degree confirming that you did all the work and deserve to have this piece of paper. And so that's one story, but obviously hundreds and hundreds of women.
So you have basically, you know, you have studied a lot of women. You have over 6,000 entries in this database that you're doing. How did you decide who to put in this book?
So I didn't limit it. Other projects that I'm working on, so I've actually got a contract for 3 more books, and the next one that comes out is The View from the Hill, which is over 300 stories of women who made their mark after 40. Mm. And so things like that, I do have to cut it off at some point. but with Uncredited, it was really because these stories are hidden, right? That's the whole point, is that these are the stories that we tend not to be told for different reasons. And so I didn't actually have to limit myself when I was writing it. And God love my editor at Rising Action is my publisher. They're woman owned, based in Canada. And she is, I would say, as passionate about this project as I am. And so she very much didn't want me to cut anything, as far as I know. and because some editors will say, like, okay, we need to get this under a certain word count or whatever. And no, she just has been fully supportive of this project from the start. And with that, she did make me stop at some point. She made me stop adding, because that's the thing about this topic, is it can be never ending. Which is also sort of where I got the term infinite women from in the first place. But because books are apparently a static medium, unlike websites, she did make me stop adding at some point. And since then, so let's say that was 8 months ago or so, I have, I think, 9 or 10 pages of additional stories that I've come across just since then. Because I don't think I will ever stop finding them.
Now, you're going to be coming to Ohio soon. You're being the featured speaker at the League of Women Voters of Ohio convention, which is May 16th to the 18th in Aurora, Ohio. How and why did you get connected with the League of Women Voters of Ohio?
So I have been very proactive in marketing the book. And the League of Women Voters is an organization that I made a priority of reaching out to. So I went and pulled every email I could find on their website. So they have all the local branches listed, and most of them have contact information. And so I was just emailing everybody, because I did feel like this was a group that the members would appreciate the work that I was doing. And clearly I was right, because they invited me to come give a talk.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Allison Tyra, the author of a new book, Uncredited: Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. Now, I wanted to go through some examples from the book. I mentioned in the introduction Mary Sherman Morgan. She worked with 900 male scientists and achieved something amazing, but she's not a household name. And she also wasn't able to get her son, actually, wasn't able to get an obituary in the LA Times. But he decided to do something about it to make sure his mother's contributions would not be forgotten. So can you tell me about Mary Sherman Morgan and what her son did to make sure she's not forgotten?
Sure. So her son actually wrote a book and a stage play, both called Rocket Girl. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, this is after he couldn't get his mother's obituary in the LA Times. And the reason wasn't because the editor was, as far as I know, being particularly sexist. It was because they couldn't verify all of these amazing things that her son was saying that she had done. And part of that you will see in the book. Some of these are situations where things were concealed for national security reasons, or, you know, that was the excuse that some jerk used, but really it was a petty personal situation. But in this case, she, as you mentioned, she developed rocket fuel That is a big reason that we are able to have things like missiles and the space program and all of that fun stuff that we love to see, I guess. And because her work hadn't been celebrated during her lifetime, there wasn't documentation. They didn't have newspaper clippings talking about this amazing work that she was doing. And so her son took that on as his duty to tell her story and ensure her legacy. And this is one of the things that I love when I do see in the book, because obviously a lot of women didn't have that. And so I mentioned earlier Marie Curie, and I think Mary Sherman Morgan's son is another great example of how men can play a very real part in ensuring that this doesn't happen.
You begin the book by mentioning Hedy Lamarr, a Hollywood star of the 30s and 40s, and considered one of the most beautiful women in the world at the time. But it's her off-screen talents that were very interesting, including inventing the technology known as frequency hopping that laid the foundation for the creation of Bluetooth, GPS, and Wi-Fi. She's been called the mother of Wi-Fi, but why have we never heard her name before?
So it's funny that you bring up both of these examples, because like I mentioned, a lot of the women's work, the reason that we don't know about it is because it was considered so important or dangerous that that it couldn't be told. And so the context that she originally developed this was in relation to communication between submarines. And so she actually was looking for a way for U.S. naval submarines to be able to communicate secretly during World War II. But she was Austrian. And so they developed this technology. Like you said, it was frequency hopping. I don't fully understand how that works. I'm sure someone more qualified to speak on that could explain it. But essentially, she and a colleague developed this concept and then made a working model and presented it to the Navy. And the Navy basically confiscated it and said, you're not allowed to talk about this, in part because Lamarr was Austrian. And so World War II, they classified it as like enemy alien technology, essentially, put it on a shelf and then didn't do anything with it. And so it was years and years later that somebody actually went back to this concept and actually started working with it.
Now, your book dives into some of the reasons why we don't know about these women. So one of the looming questions, obviously, is why are these contributions out of public view? And who it has to do with who plays the role of the gatekeeper. So historically, who has played that role? I mean, we're talking men, but also the press. Is that right?
So I don't use this in the book, but I've started using shorthand CHOM, cisgender, heterosexual, abled white men. And you could also put, you know, wealthy in there if we want to add an extra W. But no, people with privilege. And, you know, we say that the victors are the ones who tell history. And generally speaking, those have been men. But we do also see these other biases at play. And I do get into how you know, queerness and race and disability are also intersecting with gender to contribute to these things. And it's not just about what people are saying about you at the time. It's also what gets saved, because we put such an emphasis on documentation. And documentation is incredibly privileged, particularly when you consider that we prioritize written documentation over oral histories. So someone like Sybil Ludington was basically a better version of Paul Revere, right? So she rode further. She was only 17 at the time. She was going to warn her father and his troops that the British were coming to burn Danbury, Connecticut, which I don't know if some folks in Danbury, Connecticut might not be opposed to that in a modern day incarnation of Danbury, but at the time it was an important depot. And so she rode through the night, warning people, yelling out, you know, the British are coming to burn Danbury. And unlike Paul Revere, she didn't get caught, but nobody wrote a poem about her. And so Fast forward to modern day, her local chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution love her, right? She's got a statue. They have books about her in the gift shop, all of that. But the national DAR refused to grant her a title of heroine of the revolution because there's no written documentation. Her story was passed down through family oral history. And it's not just gender. There's also, you know, I've done an episode for my podcast about who tells the stories of enslaved women, and another one about women of Caribbean slave revolts. And so you can see how oral histories are very much the only option if you don't have privileges like literacy, like having the time and energy and resources to pay for supplies to keep your own records. And so the people who tell marginalized stories are often the ones oppressing those people.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Allison Tyra, the author of a new book, Uncredited, Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. She's staying with us, and coming up, can you tell us the name of the talented designer who created Jackie Kennedy's iconic wedding dress? Probably not. You're not alone, and we'll tell you why. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Throughout history, why have women's contributions to the world gone largely uncredited, been erased entirely, or otherwise diminished in importance? A new book explores that question while giving hundreds of thousands of women an unsung due. We're talking with Allison Tyra, the author of the new book, Uncredited, Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. She'll be in Ohio soon to be the keynote speaker at the League of Women Voters of Ohio convention in Aurora. And at the end of the last segment, I posed the question, who designed Jackie Kennedy's iconic wedding dress? So at the time of the wedding in 1953, press accounts did not name Ann Lowe. I should say, Allison, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
And then can you also tell me, how was that omission a reflection of the time that the name Ann Lowe wasn't in the press accounts?
Well, reputedly, Jackie said, I wanted to go to France, but a colored dressmaker did it. There is debate on whether she actually said that or whether the newspapers just reported it that way. But it's also worth noting that in all of this press coverage that we saw of the wedding, right? Because this was a huge event, right? This was the wedding of the year. And yet she is not mentioned in any of the coverage, right? So like the New York Times is describing this wedding in detail. And yet the dress, right? That today, you know, everybody would be talking about the dress and they were talking about it then. It's just her name wasn't mentioned. And in fact, she ended up losing $2,200 because 10 days before the wedding, a pipe burst in the studio. So not just the wedding dress, but also nine others that she had been commissioned to make for other members of the wedding party were just ruined. Mm. And so she and her team had to work day and night to recreate all of these dresses. And so that's about $21,000 in today's currency that she ended up losing on this job. And then she goes to hand deliver the gowns. She was told to enter through a service entrance in the back. And she said that either the dresses went with her through the front door or they went back with her to New York.
Now, this book highlights women of science, medicine, the arts, fashion. There's really no area where women have not had influence but are also not maybe not well known. Do you have a favorite story that you found that when I'm sure people ask you to pick your favorite story from the book, which was one of your favorites?
It's sort of funny that you've raised it as favorites because I know what you mean. And it's the same idea that anytime someone tells me, oh, I'm going to go read the book, my immediate response is, I hope you enjoy it. Mm. And then I'm like, oh, no, no, that's not the feeling you're going to get from this.
You're going to feel outrage or disappointment or yes.
Favorite review so far is my 68-year-old mother, a nice white lady from Indiana, saying, you know, this really f***ed me off. But one that I do like to mention is Alice Augusta Ball, who died when she was in her mid-20s. But before that, she had become the first woman and first African-American to earn a degree, a PhD in chemistry from the University of Hawaii, and to be a chemistry professor there. And she also developed the only effective treatment that we had for leprosy until sulfonamides were developed in, I believe, the 1940s. And so basically she was doing her PhD work on the kava plant, and she found a way to make the oil injectable and able to be absorbed by the body. And it slowed the progress. It didn't cure the disease or stop the progress indefinitely, but it was the best we had for like a couple decades. And because she died young, her supervisor, who was also like the department head, and he went on to become the university president, he stole her work, published it under his own name without crediting her at all. And obviously that helped his career. He named it after himself, for crying out loud. So, and one of her colleagues did try to stand up for her at the time. So going back to, you know, men who did try to be allies to offset all of these awful men that I talk about, I will say like over 90% of the men in the book are the bad guys in the stories. But I do try to shout out guys like her colleague, but he just wasn't as influential. He wasn't as powerful as the guy who stole her work. And you can also see how men benefiting from doing this to women, that increases their power, right? So a lot of times they're using like reputation and clout that they get from doing this to women to do it. It's a self-perpetuating cycle. But anyway, fortunately for all of us, her work was rediscovered in the 1970s, I believe. So you had scholars going through the archives. And this is another aspect of that, you know, documentation issue is, even if your stuff gets saved, is anyone looking at it? Is it indexed? Is it digitized? Is it findable?
Now, you also write about the way when women do get credit, it's also like the kind of backhanded compliment way that they sometimes get credited. So you write about an example is Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkin, who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, but the headline in the paper read Nobel Prize for British Wife. Right. So it's being attributed to being like her first job as being the wife of a man somewhere in Britain rather than winning the Nobel Prize in chemistry. Right.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she didn't get the Nobel Prize for being a wife. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's several examples in the book about that where, you know, they describe the woman as mother or wife rather than, you know, scientist or artist. And there's one about a famous painter here in Australia, and the title was Girl Painter Wins Prize.
What this one made me, this made me laugh. I have it written down here. So it's Nora Hayson, who won Australia's most prestigious art award. The headline read, Girl Painter Who Won Art Prize Is Also Good Cook.
Yep, because that's the most important thing. And this was like the most important prize in, I would arguably even today, I'm sure some people can debate that. But the Archibald Prize is the biggest award in Australian art.
And some of this might surprise some people on how women are not acknowledged by their own names. I mean, even tennis champ Billie Jean King was listed as Wimbledon champion when she won Wimbledon. It was listed as Mrs. L.W. King. Her husband's name was Larry. Or Chrissy Everett, I think it is. Chrissy Everett was listed as C.M. Everett, because of who she was married to. So it's being, so the husband's names live on, being like Mrs. King instead of Billie Jean King herself.
Well, and especially when those women then possibly divorce the husband, possibly change their name. Yeah, it's always funny when it's like, well, that guy didn't win Wimbledon. And my favorite example of what I call Mrs. Nameless is there was a woman who collected a bunch of samples, I want to say botanical ones. And so these were all archived at the Smithsonian, but she was credited as Mrs. Husband's name. But then when they were going through a digitization process later at some point, in the database, they removed all honorifics, so Mr. and Mrs. And so suddenly her work was credited to her husband, who had been dead when she was doing a lot of this work. And it took, you know, somebody eventually noticing that, hang on, this is not possible, and discovering what had happened. And so Mrs. Nameless has its own section in the book.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Allison Tyra, the author of the new book, Uncredited, Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. And I wanted to just for a minute talk about the glossary in the book, because my producer, Aaron Esmond-Rabinowitz, was very entertained, found it interesting, the glossary. You have some words in there, heap-eating. Can you tell me about that? What does that mean?
That is when a man repeats what a woman has said and everyone lauds him for his brilliance, whereas when she said it, it went overlooked. And I should note, I did not make that term up, but my editor did want a glossary for words like bropropriation, which is just a portmanteau for a guy stealing a woman's work.
You also have gender diminutive, so the use of girl instead of woman. Which there's examples of that everywhere. If you think of like famous books and movies, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl, The Girl on the Train. But tell me about using girl instead of women.
Well, it's funny that you mention, like The Girl on the Train, where the whole point is that woman is like post-divorce in, I believe, her late 30s. It's been a while since I read that book. Mm-hmm. But people who are clearly not girls, or we just mentioned an example with Nora Hasen and Girl Painter. You know, she was in her like mid to late 20s at that time. These are adults, and calling them girls diminishes them. It's a way to belittle them by bringing them down to the level of a child. And another example I believe I mentioned in the glossary is the term et, so E-T-T-E as a suffix. And so suffragette was actually an insulting term that a lot of us don't know today because we've all seen Mary Poppins and the song Sister Suffragette. And the Brits reclaimed suffragette. So that's why it's in the movie. But the Americans did not. So the British ones basically said, oh, you're going to call us a term that you think is insulting? Well, screw you. We'll take it for ourselves. Whereas the Americans really didn't. And so it's always funny when I see someone referring to American suffragettes, because that wasn't a term that was used by them. Typically, it was used against them.
Another thing that you mentioned earlier, that there are some famous names in the book, but just they're not attributed to their fullest extent. And one example is Anne Frank. You write about how edits and omissions to Anne Frank's diaries does a disservice to our understanding of her as a regular teen. Can you talk about the pages that were discovered in later years that really give a fuller picture of her personality, but we don't really know about them?
Sure. So this is another example of when we're talking about documentation, it's not just, okay, I wrote a diary and that's what got published. There are all of these steps in between that go into not just work being saved and preserved, but how it is presented. And so posthumous editors like her father play a big role in that. And I actually did a podcast episode with this back in 2023, where I was talking with a Dutch artist, and she was saying that, you know, we read this when I was a girl, and it wasn't relatable because the version that they present doesn't feel like a real teenager. And that's because they censored out the things that make her feel like a real person. So things that her dad, and you can understand why her dad wouldn't want things like, you know, she's talking about sexuality. She's talking about, you know, I think touching her friend's breasts, and she's talking about masturbation, and she's talking about like sex work. Not that, you know, she did it herself, obviously, mm-hmm. but just the concept of it, like, you know, teenagers working through how they see the world in their minds based on what they're seeing around them. And you can understand why a dad would not want that presented, even if that's what was her truth. And there's less scandalous things like, you know, fighting with her mom. Mm. And the reason that this does a disservice is not just that you are editing someone's words without their consent, right? That's always problematic, frankly. But it's also that you are presenting this person that modern kids can't relate to, because that doesn't resonate with them, because that's not what she really sounded like. It is not her full truth. And I think we recognize that on some level.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, you talked about how women are lost to history sometimes because it's not written down. So we understand more now the importance of record keeping. There's a section where you talk about patents. In 1880, so that's 145 years ago, an activist named Charlotte Smith persuaded the U.S. Patent Office to compile a list of women who were granted patents. And that effort to track women patent holders went forward but was flawed. Can you tell me more about that, women and patents?
So it's always funny when I present the book as like, oh, we know women are as good as men, so why haven't I heard of more women? And the answer is usually sexism. Duh. And so perhaps nowhere more so than this particular instance. So there were, I believe, 5 patent clerks who were literally assigned to just go through and count all the women's names. And there are things like, I think they just completely ignored industrial, like they just assumed that there would be no industrial inventions by women, so they're focusing specifically on like only the domestic sphere. And even then, there were just a bunch of women that they missed. And so maybe 100 years later, a Smithsonian academic went through and basically did an audit for one of these years and found, I believe it was 20 to 25% more names, like that were obviously female names, compared to what was actually documented. And so even men who have been explicitly assigned to do a count significantly undercounted.
Well, and I guess my final question will just be about to ask you about the acknowledgement in your book, because it made me laugh. It reads, "For Gerald, he knows what he did." Is there a story there? Who's Gerald? Or Gerard? I'm sorry, it's Gerard. I added.
It's actually Jared.
Jared. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, yes, there
no,
we go.
No, he gets that all the time.
He knows so what he husband. Did. Okay.
That's my husband. And he did approve that dedication. But yes, it is spelled Gerard, pronounced Jared. He gets that all the time. I actually use that when I'm checking my podcast guests, how they pronounce their names, because I say that that's why I have trust issues. Mm. But no, so we just thought it would be funny because of the connotation of the book, and because, you know, as someone who's read it, you'll know that so many of the examples are husbands stealing their wives' work or, you know, ignoring their contributions. So Pierre Curie is definitely the exception, not the rule, when it comes to publicly fighting for credit to be given. More often, it was the other way around. But yeah, whereas he knows what he did. What he did was support me and listen to me rant and cook me dinner when I was, you know, just so deep in this that I wasn't sure it was ever going to get done, and encourage me when, you know, I was sending it out to, I think, over 100 agents and publishers. And yeah, so he did all the things that a partner should do, and that many of the women did not have. from their partners.
Well, good job, Jared. There we go. and not Gerard, not Gerald, Jared. Got it. Well, I want to thank
all of them.
Yes, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Allison Tyra, author of the new book Uncredited: Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And enjoy your upcoming trip to Ohio. Good luck with your keynote speaking event.
Thank you. I'm very excited. And then I'm going to be spending time with my family in Indiana. So it's going to be a good trip.
And coming up, we are going to talk about women in Ohio and an upcoming convention that will celebrate women trailblazers. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We've been talking about the accomplishments of women with Allison Tyra, author of the new book, Uncredited: Women's Overlooked, Misattributed, and Stolen Work. She'll be in Ohio this weekend, where she will be the featured speaker at the League of Women Voters Ohio Convention. Joining us now is the League's Executive Director, Jen Miller. Welcome back to All Sides, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
So Allison's book came out just this week. What appealed to you about her work and this book to make her a good fit for you and your convention?
Well, we also had Rosie Rios in a past convention. She was the person trying to get women represented on coins. Mm. So our entire history at the League is one where we insist that women should be in public spaces. You know, we were formerly the Ohio Women Suffrage Association that became the League when the 19th Amendment was in the ratification process.
So Ohio has a history of women whose work has gone unrecognized and uncredited. And Jen, you served on the Women's Suffrage Monument Commission. So there's an Ohio Women's Monument coming to the Ohio State House. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, we're so excited about this. And this is not just Ohio. This is obviously across the world, as Allison's work shows us. But 6% of public art in the United States features real women, not allegorical women, not fictional women. On the Ohio State House, there's only one woman figure, and she's an angel from a war a monument. And so what this tells us is that it's hard to be it if you can't see it, right? Mm-hmm. If we're not imagining women as trailblazers, as leaders, it's hard to then support women in those roles, even as young women. So the suffrage monument was really a collaboration of many folks. So leaders of both political parties, the Ohio Humanities Council, the Ohio Arts Council, the Ohio History Connection. I've been honored to be part of that. It'll be unveiled next year. It'll be the first monument on the State House lawn, as I said, that features living women. It'll also be the first monument on the lawn that features people of color. So we're excited about this. The artist's name is Brenda Council. And we should just know that Ohio is central to women's suffrage. So at one point, both the National Women's Suffrage Association and the Ohio Women's Suffrage Association were here. The Temperance Union was here quite strongly. But then also, even after Ohio ratified, which was pretty early on among the states, we remain central because Cox was from Dayton and Harding was from Marion, so the two presidential candidates in 1920. So as the ratification conversations were nationally, we were putting pressure on these candidates in their hometowns, even at their home residences, to pressure their party to endorse.
Now, can you tell me what the monument's going to look like, or is it a secret at the moment?
Well, it has been unveiled. It's what I'll say is this: it is beautiful and it's inviting, and it looks back, but it also makes space for future leaders. I think if you go to the website, you'll be able to see a picture. So what I'll do is I will send something to your staff, Amy, so that you can
we'll put the link on our website. So whenever we think about honoring women of Ohio, there is a statue of Jerry Mock at the John Glenn International Airport. But then also someone anonymously donated $1 million toward, is that for your monument's completion?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what does it mean to you to have someone anonymously donate $1 million saying this needs to be, this needs to happen?
I think it just shows that representation matters. You know, when we break the chain of memory, if we are not telling an inclusive history of all the change makers, we rob future generations. So young people, it's harder for them to imagine a future where we're all working together to make a vibrant Ohio if we're not telling an inclusive story. And so I'm very excited. I have spent a lot of time at the State House, obviously, and I see all these school groups. And I want young men and women to see that Ohio has always been led by a diverse group of people. I think that's going to make our future brighter.
Now, Allison Tyra's book, Uncredited, that we've been talking about, also talks about women who had their accomplishments diminished. And that brings to mind former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor and her portrait. Can you remind us of what happened there?
Right. So she has this beautiful portrait upon her retirement that was in the main hallway, or what's called the Grand Concourse of the Supreme Court building. And that was unceremoniously moved to the ground floor with just a printout sign that said "Coming Soon, Women in Law" exhibit. That could have been retribution for some of the decisions she made, like supporting nonpartisan redistricting reform. It felt similar to when Householder removed Joanne Davidson's picture from the House chamber. So you have the first Supreme Court justice who gets moved to kind of the ground floor or basement level, kind of unceremoniously. And similarly, Householder had a grudge against Joanne Davidson, the first woman Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. That didn't get put back into the chambers until Cupp became Speaker.
Mm. Now, the League of Women Voters Convention is taking place May 16th through the 18th. It's in Aurora. Can you give us a little overview? Is it open to the public? Who comes to this event?
Yeah, so the convention itself is open to anyone, though it's really a governance convention. We were born out of the Ohio Women's Suffrage Association convention in downtown Columbus in 1820. But we have a gala. We have an award ceremony where we celebrate leaders across the state, both that are part of League or are not, for just living League values of equality and democracy. And so the sales for our fundraising gala, it's a fun event. It's great food. There's a silent auction. It'll have Allison Tyra and she'll be signing books afterwards. That event is on Saturday night and tickets are still available until midnight tonight. They just need to go either probably to your website, you probably have it up, but also lwvohio.org.
Okay. Now, the awards you're mentioning, are these the Trailblazer Awards?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So the Trailblazer Awards were established in 2019 to recognize outstanding members and partners. Local leagues have gone above and beyond who have defended our democracy, people who are making extraordinary difference in the lives of people in our community. Can you tell me some of the past winners of your Trailblazer Award?
There have been so many. And again, there are folks that are very well known household names like Maureen O'Connor or Joan Lawrence, who is a former state rep here from Central Ohio, but also folks that you may not know, like Peg Rosenfield, who has now passed on, but helped write a whole bunch of our election integrity and security and access laws here in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, I can remember that name from being on All Sides with Ann Fisher back in the day. I
did.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Ohio women's accomplishments with Jen Miller of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. So defending democracy, that's a role that the League has played throughout history, ensuring voting rights and access to the ballot box, and women have been at the forefront of that movement. So I just want to talk for a little bit about the primary election we had last week. There were statewide infrastructure issue. There were a number of local levies for schools and libraries and fire service, but the turnout was about 10%. So I know that there was nothing huge on the ballot, but what comes to mind when you hear about a low voter turnout like that, barely 10%?
Yeah, this hurts our heart at the League. We know that every election matters. And in fact, those local elections impact our daily lives. We have, obviously, we're still settling and can't doing the final canvas, the final counts. But across the state, we have races that are going to be decided by less than a dozen votes. Mm-hmm. And this is where it hurts, because we have so much conversation right now about elections and politics, but a lot of folks didn't even know there was an election. Mm-hmm. Why? Because most of the organizing around elections is by candidates at the federal or state level that are going and knocking on doors. And this is where we all need to lean in more. And where groups like the League need more support, we need more volunteers so that we can truly spread the word and make sure folks are participating.
Now, in a primary like we had last week, a May primary, you know, there's no big things on the ballot. There was no governor. There was no president. But it's those smaller. How do you communicate to people that it's those smaller elections? It's the city council candidate, the township supervisor, the school board member that really impacts their daily lives more than just than the governor.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, first and foremost, I think democracy is alive and well at the local level if we work it. So we should be making sure that everyone is showing up to vote, but then showing up to city council or county commission and telling those folks what it is we want to see in our communities. Why? Again, because these elections are often determined by so fewer votes, they have to be responsive mm-hmm. to the people. And so, you know, whether it's school levy, where we are, do the kids have art and football or not? Do they have new computers or not? Local judge, almost all of us go before a local mm-hmm. judge at some point, whether it's traffic court or a family law issue. And so local judges affect our daily lives. But I think the thing that hurts my heart the most is I had so many people actually call our office after the fact saying, I didn't even know there was an election, which means we're failing, right? That we all together need to do a better job making sure that everyone knows. One of the first ways I think we can do that is funding boards of elections to do more education.
Okay. And what sort of things would boards of elections, if they had more money, had more people to be able to do that? I mean, how would you get more people to come out for a May primary that only had three things on the ballot?
Well, I mean, I think, again, let's start by, you know, we see in the major election years, we see funding for ads on COTA buses, mm-hmm. maybe, right? Or maybe PSAs on various radio stations. Social media. So I think that is very critical. But I also do agree with you, Amy, that we need to start not just talking about who's on the ballot, but what their jobs are. Because I think that once we better understand what jobs, they're like job openings. And we, the voters, are the hiring committee.
Yeah. What does the auditor do?
Right. Exactly. And then once we start to understand that, we're more interested in the election. We have better tools for deciding which candidate we think is best. And then once they take office, we can be advocating for our interests and needs.
Now, there's been growing concerns about ongoing efforts at the federal and state level to make voting harder, more hurdles being put in place. But this is also to make elections more secure. They want it to make sure that the people who are voting are doing it correctly and everything is by the book. So what are you watching for in particular in upcoming elections when it comes to people having access to vote?
Yeah. So, and I love that you talked about access and security. Those are not diametrically opposed. Mm-hmm. So the League has always been both. Here in Ohio, things like the bipartisan control of boards of elections, where there's oversight from everything from the board meetings all the way down to a Republican and Democrat key to get machines or to start the tabulation. Mm-hmm. League actually championed that. Similarly, the first post-election audits in Ohio were achieved through litigation that the League brought with allies. And so we care deeply about security. And the good news in Ohio is that we have very, very secure elections. And we see that throughout the country, but I can especially say that here in Ohio, Husted and LaRose continue to talk about how secure our elections are. Both, one was a Republican Secretary of State, one is currently now. And so the bottom line is, we need to decide what we're solving for. Mm-hmm. We have secure elections. At this point, trying to make them more secure really is just going to take away access. And we're already seeing that with some of the laws that have already passed in Ohio.
So what particular things are you watching for in upcoming elections? Are we has anything changed recently with voter ID or anything that people need to know heading into there'll be an election in November. There's one, you know. So what do we need to be thinking about whenever it comes to voting?
Well, I mean, what we are seeing right now is that the voter ID law that was passed a few years ago, and we now have the strictest voter ID in the country, in Ohio. And what have we seen? What we've seen is more provisional ballots, more voters being disenfranchised. It hasn't increased security whatsoever.
So what about it is the most strict? It's what, which IDs you're allowed to use?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So yep. Which ones are you allowed to use?
Yeah. So right now, you can use a BMV issued ID as long as it's unexpired. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have the correct address on there, but it has to be unexpired. So that's a state ID or a driver's license, mm-hmm. passport, book, or card, which is new. Mm-hmm. And then a U.S. veteran or U.S. military ID. Those are the only ones that count. So, for example, for a long time, a lot of veterans use their county veteran ID. Mm-hmm. That no longer counts. Mm-hmm. If you are a student, you could use a printout, something like maybe from the registrar at Ohio State. You could use a government check. So we had ID that proved identity because these are things that would be hard to have otherwise. But now it is so strict that probably about 10% of Ohioans don't have this ID. And they tend to be seniors, people with disabilities, students, lower income individuals.
That was Jen Miller, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, and their 2025 convention is May 16th through the 18th in Aurora. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich.